From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. Well, what do the names Frank Sinatra, Zager and Evans, John Denver, Robert Altman, and Steven Soderbergh have in common? My guest, producer, impresario, Jerry Weintraub. His new book, his autobiography, is called When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. Jerry, first of all, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things that comes across so clearly in the book, all these people you've met, that you had chemistry with all of these people you end up working with. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. I mean, I have a simpatico for artists, and I understand them, and I like them, and I enjoy creating art with them, whether it's music or whether it's poetry or whether it's film or whether it's Broadway shows or whether I've done it all, done all those things. So I always say that the proudest moment, the proudest week I ever had was the first Sunday morning that I opened the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, and I was represented in every section, Broadway, concerts, records, music, whatever, television.
And film.
I was represented in every section. I had an ad. Jerry Weintraub presented something.
But, you know, it's almost like in all these cases in the book you talk about that, it becomes almost like this kind of brotherhood. You become like brothers with these guys, you know? Yeah. I mean, it happened with somebody like Bobby Fischer almost. That kind of thing happened. That's one of my favorite sections.
He was wacky.
But that's one of my favorite sections of the book.
My wacky brother there.
Yeah. But you were able to read him pretty fast, though, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I can read. I'm very intuitive about artists, and I understand what they need. And I understand they need another half. They have the artistic half, and they need somebody else that they can talk to and that they'll listen to, that they respect, and who they will eventually come around to saying, oh, you know, I'm going to cooperate with this guy, and I'm going to let this guy in. I'm going to let this guy into my creative process. I'm going to let him understand what I'm doing and why I want to get to where I want to get, because I know he can help me get there. And if I go into an editing room with a director, or I go into an editing room with a musician, or I go into a room with somebody who's writing a Broadway show or whatever, it's a collaboration. It becomes a collaboration. So I become more than a producer or a promoter or a manager or anything like that. It's more of a collaboration with the artists that I work with.
I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. My guest is producer and impresario Jerry Weintraub. His autobiography is When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. But so many of these ideas, and I want to talk to you about this, came to you when you were in bed.
Yeah, well, that's a good place to be. I've had a lot of fun in bed. Bed is a good place.
It's almost like you're in bed, one of these, like, thought balloons with, like, a light bulb pops above your head when you're in bed.
Yeah. The thing is, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, and I believe in God, and I really believe that there's a higher power that guides me through this whole thing, just takes me through it. And I have had incidents in my life that had to come from someplace else. For instance, when I met Elvis Presley, or when I thought about promoting Elvis Presley before I really was equipped or had done anything really important, I had this dream, and I had a pad next to my bed, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wrote, Jerry Weintraub presents Elvis at Madison Square Garden. And I showed it to my wife, and she said to me, what are you, crazy? Go to sleep. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, well, I don't sleep anyway. So I said, no, I'm going to get Elvis Presley. She said, you know Elvis Presley? I said, no, I don't know Elvis Presley. Well, how are you going to do that? I said, I will do that. And I got on the phone the next morning, called the Colonel Parker, that was his manager. I found in my life that you can reach anybody who's important. They pick the telephone up. People who aren't important, You can't reach. You have a hard time reaching them. But you can reach the chairman of the board of any major corporation in this country, and I've done it. Before I did it before I was famous. And they talk to you because they have nothing to hide. Anyway, I call the colonel every day for one solid year, every morning. That was my first phone call when I got up. And we struck up a friendship on the telephone. And he kept telling me, I was never going to get Elvis. I was never going to get Elvis. I was never going to get Elvis. And finally, one day after 1 year, he said to me, you still want my boy? And I said, yes, I want to promote Elvis Presley. And he said, okay, meet me tomorrow in Las Vegas. Bring $1 million check. Now, in those days, $1 million was real money, real money. And I had to find $1 million. And I only thought that Rockefeller had $1 million or the Whitneys or the Paysons or those kind of people. I never dreamt of getting $1 million together. But a lot of people around New York City used to say to me, you know, kid, you're a smart kid. If you ever get an idea, give me a call and I'll give you some money. So I went to all those people. Nobody gave me any money. Nobody came up with a nickel. Not a nickel. And I went to Las Vegas. I had a meeting with him the next day. When I got to Las Vegas, I got a phone call from a guy in New York, an attorney, who said to me, call this number. He gave me a number. In Seattle, Washington, there's a man there named Lester Smith, and he'll probably do this deal with you. So I called him, and he said to me, what do I get for my $1 million? What do I get? I said, you get half of my concert business. I had no concert business at the time, really. I had a few shows, but nothing really important. I said, I'll give you half my concert business. He said, okay, let's get the lawyers together and we'll figure out a contract. I said, no, you don't understand. I need $1 million now. I have to give it to him in about 4 hours or 5 hours. He said, well, we don't have a piece of paper. I said, you have my word of honor. And he sent me $1 million to a Las Vegas bank. I remember like it was yesterday, I went downtown Las Vegas and there was this bank, the Royal Bank of Nevada. It had a gold crown and a purple velvet front on the bank. It did not look anything like a bank. And I walked in, there was a young lady behind the table, and I said to her, I have $1 million cashier's check arriving from Seattle, Washington. She said, looked at me like I was nuts. You know, it was Las Vegas. And I was in a pair of jeans. And I had long hair and I had sideburns and cowboy boots on. I sat there for about 3 hours and out came the president of the bank. He was about 12 years old, maybe 13. And he said, are you Jerry Weintraub? I said, yes. Come in my office. I went into his office, took out a cashier's check for $1 million. And he said, this check is made out to Elvis Presley for $1 million. What are you going to do with Elvis Presley? I said, I'm going to take him on a tour around the country. And he said to me, do you need an accountant? He was ready to leave his job.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Jerry Weintraub, impresario, producer, promoter. His book, his autobiography is When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. Did you ever tell Elvis that story?
No. In fact, the only thing Elvis ever asked me for was, Jerry, I have two requests, nothing else. I said, well, anything you want. He said, I want you to make sure that every seat in the house is full. And I want you to make sure that the first 20 rows go to my fans, not to any big shots. Don't put the mayor and the governor up in the front rows. Put my fans up there. Well, because of my naivete and my not having been an impresario at the time, you know, just pretending to be one, I booked the first date in Miami Beach, Florida on July 4th weekend. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in Miami Beach on July 4th weekend, but it's quite humid, quite hot, and anybody with a brain leaves. So I had 10,000 seats to fill, and I had promised them I'd sell every seat in the house. I called down there, and they said, you're sold out, 10 days before we were coming. And I said, that's great. And the guy said, would you like to do a matinee? And I said, sure, you know, sure. So I put the matinee on sale. When we got to Miami, I went to the arena, and I looked in the box office. It was the day before the show, and there were tickets, lots of tickets in the box office. That is not a good thing when you're selling them. That means nobody came in and bought them. So I said to this fellow, "What you told me we were sold out," and he had told me we were sold out for the afternoon show as well, matinee. So after I jumped across the counter, grabbed him by the collar, and shook him, tried to shake him to death, really, shook him. And I said, you're going to ruin my career. What the hell's the matter with you? And he said to me, I just told you what you wanted to hear. And I walked out. I went out in the arena. Elvis showed up with the colonel. I went over to the colonel, and I said, Colonel, we have a problem. I have 5,000 seats left for the matinee tomorrow. And I promised Elvis there would never be an empty seat. And he said to me, son, we don't have a problem. You have a problem. And I walked outside to get some air and try to get myself together. And I saw the county jail, Miami Beach County Jail. It was right next to the convention center. And I went into the jail. I met the warden in the jail. And I said to him, I need to buy some time from your prisoners to come into the arena and do some work for me. He said, well, we'll make a deal. So we made a deal. The prisoners came in to the Miami Beach Convention Center. They unscrewed, because the chairs were screwed to the floor, 5,000 seats, which I put out in the parking lot and covered them with a blue tarp. I remember the light. I could see it. I can see it so clearly. Covered him with a blue tarp. After Elvis finished the matinee, I had the prisoners come back, and I put the 5,000 seats back for the night show. So every seat was full. And the only thing Elvis ever said to me about it was, I had dinner with him after the show, and he said to me, you know, Jerry, the audiences at night are much more interested in the show. It's much louder. They're really excited, and they're not so excited in the afternoon. I said, okay.
Now, about Colonel Parker, though, you must have felt that he knew exactly what he wanted all the time, but he was interested in other ideas. I mean,
I don't think he knew exactly what he wanted all the time. I think he flew by the seat of his pants.
Really? Okay.
But he was a great marketing guy.
Okay.
And he taught me a tremendous amount about marketing. And the first thing he taught me, which I carried through my whole career in film and Broadway, everything I did, he said to me, Jerry, forget about New York and Los Angeles. And he said to me, you'll be accepted in those places and you'll get your table at 21. Everything will be fine. But when you want to sell music, when you want to sell film, when you want to sell television, when you want to sell radio, there's a big United States out there. Everything is not the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. There are other people out there. Sell to them. They buy more.
We'll take a break. My guest is Jerry Weintraub. His book is When I Stop Talking, You Know I'm Dead. I'm Elvis, the other Elvis. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. Jerry Weintraub presents The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. He's sitting across from me. His autobiography is just out. When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. You also worked with directors who made two of the most pivotal films of the 20th century. You worked with Robert Altman on Nashville and Barry Levinson on Diner. And the other thing that comes across to me from the book is you were really attracted to guys who were really confident in themselves as artists. And Altman, and you even talk about the book that, you know, you didn't expect that Levinson was going to want to direct Diner, but he was so confident that you thought, give this guy a shot.
Yeah, well, Nashville, starting with Nashville. And
he came to you and said you should be making movies.
Yeah, he came to a party at my house for President Bush. He was ambassador to the United Nations at the time, the first President Bush, who's a friend, a good friend of mine. John Denver was at Carnegie Hall. And I gave George Bush, who was ambassador to the United Nations, tickets for all the other ambassadors from all over the world who he brought to the show. And then I made a party at my house that evening for Ambassador Bush and all the rest of these ambassadors. And I wanted to have movie stars there and directors there and artistic people, you know. So my wife went through a list. In those days, it was called the Blackwell List. And that list had whatever celebrities were in town at the time. And on the list was Robert Altman. And I was a big, big Altman fan because he had done McCabe and Mrs. Miller and MASH at the time. And Altman came to the party. He and I started had a drink together. And we were sitting in a corner. And he said to me, you should be a film producer. Well, I've been thinking about it, you know, but I make a lot of money in the music business. He said, yeah, but you, Jerry, you're going to want to get into the film business because you can express yourself more in the film business. And he said, I have a script. And he sent Nashville over to the house, and I read it. I didn't understand a word of it. I absolutely didn't get it. And I called him, and I said, Robert, I appreciate you wanting me to do this, but I don't get it. I don't understand it. He said, let's have lunch. We went to lunch. He explained to me what he was going to do with the movie. And he was a great director. And that's maybe one of my best talents, you know, hooking up with the right people and believing in them and letting them do their thing, you know. And I said to him, okay, I'm going to do this movie. How much is it going to cost? He said, $2 million. And I said, okay, I'll do it. He said, what do you mean? You'll do it. I'll finance it. He said, no, you don't do it that way. You go to a movie studio and they'll let them pay for it. Why should you pay for it? I said, no, I'll pay for it. Let me just do this. And I said, look, you and I are partners. I'll put up the $2 million. We'll split all the profits 50-50 and we'll go from there. You work for nothing. I'll work for nothing. He said, great, let's do it. Within a week, I had sold the rights, the television rights, which hadn't been done in those days, to ABC. And I got all my money back plus a big profit. And Altman and I had a big check to sit on. And then he went out and made this brilliant, brilliant movie, which was up for every award and, you know, was heralded. And is still on most critics' top five list of all time. So that was Altman. Levinson and Diner. Levinson was a writer. He wrote with Mel Brooks and worked with Mel Brooks.
Yeah, he worked on High Anxiety, and he also wrote on the old Carol Burnett show and hadn't made a movie before.
Exactly, and never directed a movie. He sent me this script, Diner, and I took the script home. I read it. I read it in an hour and a half. It was a great read, much like my book.
Oh, I'm sorry. That book was When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. That's Jerry Weintraub's autobiography. It's sitting here right here in front of me.
Sorry to lead you into that, Elvis.
That's very subtle. But anyway,
it was a great read, like my book, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. And I knew.
And you say in the book, When I Stop Talking, You Know I'm Dead, that you recognize a lot of the characters in the script because they're like people that you knew.
Absolutely. That's what attracted me to Diner. The fact is that all of Barry's friends who are in Diner, those are the characters that he grew up with, the people he grew up with, are the same people that I grew up with in the Bronx and in Brooklyn. So they weren't any different. They were from Baltimore, but they weren't any different. They had different accent. And when a character comes off the page for you and you want to make a film and there's a great story and great characters, you know you got something important. You know, especially in those days before all this 3D Clash of the Clashes. whatever that stuff is.
Well, we're not in 3D here, but we're in stereo. It's the treatment. My guest is Jerry Weintraub, producer, impresario. His book, what's it called again? Oh, yes. When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. I got to ask you, though, because before we got started, I was asking you about John Denver, whose autobiography I dug up and read before we came together today. And
you know, Elvis, I hate to interrupt you, but this is a frightening interview because you've actually read my book and read other books. So, I don't usually get interviewed by people who read.
But you talk very interestingly about John Denver and about finding him and nurturing him and the way you use your own network to get Sinatra to mention him and Elvis Presley to mention him. And there's a lot of anger in his autobiography, which you haven't read. But you said you didn't think he was an angry guy. You just thought of something else.
No, I don't think he was angry. I thought he got confused.
You talk about that in the book, but his dad died, and then he divorced his wife. Wanted to do away with all the things that made him John Denver.
Fired me.
Yes.
I think he lost his way. And I think one of the reasons he lost his way was that he wanted very, very much to be accepted by the critics.
To be taken seriously.
Yeah. And he wasn't taken seriously by the music critics. He was taken seriously by the public, which is much more important.
But you just said something very interesting. You're talking about Altman. You talked about his critical reception. In the 70s, that world of criticism was very important. I mean, because you talk in the book about a kind of Emerson, a kind of a party for Procol Harum that you threw, a record listening party, and Jan Wenner read you the Riot Act.
In Procol Harum, for Moody Blues.
Moody Blues, I'm sorry, yeah.
Actually, it was right here in Carnegie Hall.
Oh, gee, okay.
That I did that. The story is that I sold the Moody Blues in America and around the world as everybody's second favorite act. Because everybody loved the Beatles, or they loved the Stones, and I never tried to be number one. I got that from Hertz and Avis. So I sold them as everybody's second favorite act. The Moody Blues had a great run. They were a wonderful band, Knights in White Satin, et cetera, et cetera. And I loved them. They were a really fantastic band. They're still friends of mine today. And they split up, like most bands do. Most bands split up, you know, at a certain point because
they get sick of each other.
No, they don't. What happens is they stop creating, and they get too big. They're making too much money, and they put a map of the world behind their desk, and they put pins in it, and they start becoming businessmen. They start looking at profit and loss statements.
Okay.
So the Moody Blues broke up.
Right.
And the lead guitar player and the lead singer, bass player, John Lodge and Justin Haywood, made an album called The Blue Jays. And they gave me the album. And I was trying to figure out how to introduce this album to the world. So I hired Carnegie Hall, which I did. I did many shows here. I did Sinatra here. I did Judy Garland here. I did everybody here. And I hired Carnegie Hall, and I invited press from all around the world because this is the Palace of Music. So I invited press from all around the world, and Jan Wiener was there, and so was, you know, every important writer of the time. And everybody sat down in Carnegie Hall, and the curtains came up, and on the stage there were speakers, and I played the record. That's all I did, was play the record. And they sat there and they listened to the record. And they did crazy things, like somebody would say, sit down, I can't see you. You know, they were looking at a speaker on a stage. Anyway, when it was over, I had this press conference, and Jan Wiener was at the press conference for Rolling Stone. And he said to me, you're a charlatan. You're P.T. Barnum. How can you bring people from all over the world to sit here and listen to a record? And I said, this is the greatest place in the world to hear music. If you're a musician, you want to go to Carnegie Hall. If you're a singer, you want to go to Carnegie Hall. We worked 2 years on this album. And then I send it out to you at home, and you listen to it in your house. Now, I don't know what kind of a sound system you have. And I don't know if your baby is spitting up pablum on your shoulder while you're listening to the record, or if you're in a fight with your wife or your dog is sick. I wanted you right here listening to the music. Now, if you don't like it, it's my problem.
It's the Treatment. I guess it's Jerry Weintraub. His book, I think, is called When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. But I want to get back to John Denver, though, because
yes.
You were saying you thought he was confused. And also, because, again, we're saying in that period in the 70s, that kind of critical approval was as important to people as popular support. And that's what you felt like. Because he must have seen your line for people, too. You had Led Zeppelin. You right. had Elvis. You right. had Frank Sinatra. All these people who were taken seriously by the press. Right. He must have felt like he really was everybody's second favorite compared to those guys.
Yeah, he did. And I think that hurt him. That's the thing that confused him.
Because at that time, not only was he a best-selling artist, but he was starring in the number one movie in the country. And he was even hosting the Tonight Show at that time, too.
That confused him, too.
What do you mean?
It confused him because...
We're also talking about the movie, Oh God.
I put him in the movie, mm-hmm. Oh God,
yes,
with George Burns. And he was great in the movie, but he didn't want to have those glasses on. And he didn't, you know, his signature glasses is like the Nike swoosh. You know, it's like if Nike threw the swoosh away tomorrow. Phil Knight said, I don't need that swoosh anymore. Give it over to Adidas. He wanted to get rid of his glasses. And I said, why do you want to get rid of your glasses? Well, I want to look handsome. I don't look as handsome as I should look with glasses on. I said, no, you do. You have, that's your signature. You get. But he didn't get that. He wanted to be Robert Redford. And then he started to get involved in the material and the film material.
Talk about the movie you developed for him.
I developed the movie for him. A great movie that Richard Gere ended up doing.
An Officer and a Gentleman.
And it was An Officer and a Gentleman, which I developed from scratch with Doug Day Stewart. And I gave it to John, and he said, that's not a good enough script for me.
He actually said that?
Yeah.
Did you?
But I did a terrible thing to him with a script because I was so busy in those days. And in those days, I didn't know who Chaucer was, you know, and I produced Chaucer on Broadway.
Yes.
But I got a script one day. He wanted to start acting. It's before Oh God. He wanted to start acting. And I got a script from Aaron Spelling or some big television producer who was doing a show. And it was about euthanasia. So I got the script and I took it over to John. He was hosting the Tonight Show. And I threw it on the table and I said, here's a script. I don't think you should do it. He said, why? I said, it's about a kid in Asia. What do you know about kids in Asia? He said, it's about euthanasia, not about kids in Asia. Of course, I hadn't read it.
Jerry, we're out of time. I'm sorry. Thanks so much for doing this. My guest is Jerry Weintraub. His book is When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. If you have comments about today's show, and I'm sure you do, just go to kcrw.com/thetreatment and let us know. Today's show is recorded at Carnegie Studios by Leszek Wojciech, where Jerry Weintraub spent a whole lot of time. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.